Trade Bites. Trade Bites. The podcast about trade policy.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Trade Bites, the podcast series by the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy, and hosted by me, Chris Horsman, Deputy Editor of the Trade Policy News Service, Borderlex. Trade Bites is the podcast series that metaphorically pushes its hand down the back of that old sofa that is UK trade policy, searching for those overlooked 50 P's worth of wisdom and insight. And in today's episode, we are scrutinising the topic of scrutiny. How do we know that the trade policy decisions which are being made by the government on our behalf are the right ones? Are they delivering value? Have they got their priorities right? On March the 22nd this year, the House of Commons ratified the UK's accession to the Asia-Pacific Trade Bloc, CPTPP, as it is affectionately known. Now, if that event passed you by, well, it was probably the same for a lot of our MPs, none of whom actually got to vote on that ratification. Under current law, there is simply no requirement for the government to hold such a vote. But what are the prospects for changing those laws to improve trade scrutiny, if in fact that's what needs to happen? There are at least seven more new UK free trade agreements currently under negotiation. So the question is a pressing one. And what level of involvement should there be for the UK's devolved administrations and other stakeholders? How could we make the process more inclusive? Well, to look at these questions in depth, I'm joined today by a great panel of experts from different locations and different disciplines. I'm joined by Alan Winters, Professor of Economics at the University of Sussex and co-director of the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy. It's a pleasure to welcome Mary Spowage, Professor of Practice at the University of Strathclyde and director of the Fraser of Allen Institute. Welcome also to Alexander Horn, a barrister and visiting professor of law at Durham University. And I'm joined also by Alan Ramsey, Director for International Trade and Investment at the Department for the Economy in Northern Ireland. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. Alan Winters, can you set the scene for us just to start with? What are the mechanisms and processes by which UK trade agreements are absorbed into UK law?
Strictly speaking, free trade agreements are treaties. Treaties are made in the UK under the royal prerogative. They're negotiated and signed, and actually Parliament needn't even know anything about it. The first stage that Parliament gets into this process is where they are asked to ratify an agreement that, let me reiterate, has already been signed. If they fail to do so, they have to do so explicitly. Otherwise, it goes through exactly as Chris has just commented about the CPTPP. If the trade agreement involves primary legislation, things that Parliament has to legislate on, it does that. And by convention, it has the right to do that before ratification is proposed. The important thing about those two stages where Parliament gets a look in, it's after all the negotiations and the signature have been done. It involves the UK ripping up something which, you know, as a society, we have already negotiated. Now, actually, it's slightly more acceptable than that. The government does now publish objectives, and it's possible to have an informal debate about that. And the government has agreed in principle that there can be debates on final agreements, but not with a view to throwing the thing out. But even that last thing is subject to the parliamentary timetable, and guess who controls the parliamentary timetable? So with CPTPP, would you believe it, there wasn't time to have the debate. So basically, it's the government that decides, and lots of things in trade agreements actually don't require primary legislation, so Parliament doesn't even get a look in there. They're regulations, they're promises which governments make. So the thing proceeds more or less without Parliament.
Of course, scrutiny of trade policy is a relatively new thing for the UK. Obviously, until Brexit happened, this was primarily the EU's responsibility. Alex, do you get a sense that perhaps Britain wasn't really prepared for what an autonomous trade policy would mean in terms of scrutiny?
Yes, I think it's worth acknowledging where things stood. I was legal advisor to both the European Union Committee and the International Agreements Committee in the House of Lords during the Brexit process. And the first thing to remember is that when we started all of this, the UK had to renegotiate somewhere around 60 free trade agreements with parties that the EU had agreements with, which the UK would fall out of post-Brexit. And that was actually done very well, but that was when the scrutiny first started. And scrutiny in that regard was very much looking to see whether the government had achieved the same type of agreements that the EU had previously. So one wasn't really looking qualitatively at new deals. One was looking just to see whether or not some previous objectives had been met. And I think what we've seen now is organic growth. The work is principally done in the House of Lords because they have an International Agreements Committee which scrutinises pretty much every agreement and certainly the trade agreements in detail. The Commons set up an International Trade Committee, but that has since gone by the by and been replaced by a much wider focused Business and Trade Committee. What happened was in the Lords, Lord Grimstone, then Trade Minister, made a series of commitments to both the International Agreements Committee and the then International Trade Committee about how this would be done. And I would say that that has worked quite well in the House of Lords, which does scrutiny, but finds it hard to hold the government to account because it doesn't have much say in the process. It's worked much less well in the House of Commons, where on two occasions, both in respect of a trade deal with Australia and more recently with the CPTPP, the government has simply said there's no time available to look at this arrangement. And I think it's fair to say that's very much not in the spirit of the agreement. And probably given that it says that a debate would be held if parliamentary time allowed, not really in the letter of the agreement either, because the various committees gave a lot of notice about CPTPP, and I think the government was well aware, well in advance, that a debate was wanted. But it's worth noting that even in those contexts, this is scrutiny without accountability. There is no provision for a vote in any of these arrangements. And as Alan alerted us earlier, what Parliament's looking at is a signed deal. So it's already been agreed. There's very little that Parliament can do to change it. It really only has a nuclear option of trying to bring it down.
Let's broaden the discussion out a little bit. Mary, what are we actually scrutinising for? I mean, what are the benchmarks against which UK trade policy should be assessed?
In any policy area, we would expect that Parliament would be scrutinising whether the policies that a government's pursuing are likely to achieve the sort of stated aims. In many policy areas, the government would have a particular strategy with objectives and then be implementing policies. And, you know, a select committee or topic committee in the devolved administration would be trying to scrutinise about whether the actions pursued by the government are likely to achieve stated aims, whether those aims are the correct ones, and what's happening in practice once these policies are put into place. I mean, one of the issues with trade policy is that in terms of the strategic framework for trade policy, it's non-existent for the UK. So it makes it much more difficult for us to say, will this particular agreement meet the objectives of the government's trade strategy, because it doesn't have one to be able to measure that against. So the lack of that strategic framework does make scrutiny more difficult. But the other thing that makes scrutiny difficult is just our understanding of what the impacts of different sorts of agreements might be. I'm a researcher in the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy, and the big challenges that we come up against are the quality of data on trade within the UK and really understanding what the impact will be on different industries, different regions of the UK, of different agreements. We're really working quite blind. So even if there was parliamentary scrutiny prior to agreements being signed, I would question to what extent we have the required evidence in the UK to really allow MPs to scrutinise agreements to really understand what the impacts would be. So we do have a big challenge here of really understanding what impacts the different agreements are going to be in the end for the economy.
And just to make things even more complicated, we have different levels of government within the United Kingdom. Alan Ramsey, what role do the UK's devolved administrations currently play in formulating trade policy and scrutinising trade agreements?
probably no more complicated region within the UK than Northern Ireland, I would say. First thing I want to acknowledge is since Brexit, actually the devolved administrations have developed a really good working relationship with UK government and DBT around its international trade agreement programme. So credit where credit's due on that. I think all sides recognise that we are treading a fairly fine policy line here between what's reserved and what's devolved in the international trade space. So just to be really clear, international relations, including trade policy, is a reserved matter under the Northern Ireland Devolution Settlement. So that's the 1998 NI Act. But of course, as we know, much of international trade cuts across devolved policy areas, most obviously agriculture, also areas like procurement, as we've seen through the CPTPP Bill, now Act, and wider devolved environmental and economic development issues. So Northern Ireland, and indeed the DA's, in terms of that specific formulation and scrutiny role, Chris, is really defined in that legal context, which is each of the devolution settlements. It's fair to say we have good communication and sharing of sensitive information with DBT. For sure, we have some gripes about how that information is shared and when it's shared, but I think overall the level of transparency is quite good. We have very regular engagement at official level and the ability to comment on texts, fitting in the specific NI interests around areas and issues as those arise through a negotiation. Now, having said that, good engagement and good communication channels, yes, very important, but doesn't always guarantee a good outcome from our perspective. The Australia-New Zealand deals have already been referenced, and I would say certainly from our then minister's perspective, they didn't reflect the view on how agricultural market access should have been handled. More generally, we know that many of the issues raised by the DAs, and I think my DA colleagues would support this, particularly around agri-food tariffs, market access, but not exclusively there, haven't really been addressed satisfactorily from our perspective. So I don't think the process is necessarily perfect from a DA perspective. Again, I think Welsh and Scottish colleagues would row in behind that. But I think I also have to mention just in Northern Ireland, we also have had our own complications, which has made this involvement probably slightly trickier than in Scotland and Wales around the political landscape. We've had to expend a lot of energy and time on the GB-EU aspects of trade, participating in the wider international trade discussions around FTAs, but on a less intense basis, I think it's fair to say. So a lot more uncertainty in Northern Ireland, but we do have the restoration of the executive, so hopefully, you know, we now have a renewed focus on ministerial input.
Okay, so plenty to unpack there. Let's talk about the Constitutional Reform and Governance Act, as people frequently do when they're down the pub on a Friday night. It's the act under which trade agreements and other international treaties are ratified by the UK Parliament. When people talk about CRAG, as it's often referred to, the phrase you most often hear in association with it is not fit for purpose. But I'm just wondering, what are the potential alternatives? Should CRAG be replaced? Should it be amended in some way? What's your view, Alex?
If you look at what CRAG does at the moment, it allows for very few things. It imposes a requirement on the government to lay the signed treaty before Parliament. It requires the government to provide an explanatory memorandum setting out what this new agreement is. And if Parliament votes against the signed deal within the 21 days that it's been laid, then in theory, ratification is delayed. Now, to my mind, it's really the government that's doing the ratification of these deals. They're passing through Parliament, and Parliament is scrutinising them, and it's getting to have its say via the select committees. But that's pretty much it. And I think Holger Hestemeyer and I produced a report for the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy back in January, where we've argued that you're not going to see a better approach unless or until the House of Commons is allowed a veto power on these agreements specifically, so that it gets the right to have a vote if it wants one. And that's, I think, the essential point, because that's where you begin to then have the leverage to demand information, to demand inputs elsewhere in the process. Unless there is that sort of up or down vote at the end of the process, then the government can provide all sorts of information late in the day and say, this is all great, but Parliament doesn't have the leverage to get its own way.
I guess I would say the up and down vote at the end is absolutely critical, but I think actually you've got to put some stuff in at the beginning so that Parliament is informed as the process goes along. And that involves some discussion of the objectives, although frankly, objectives are wish lists, not very concrete documents. And then a commitment to inform Parliament, possibly on a confidential basis to the committees, about the progress. In other words, if you just arrived at the very end with the threat, look, we've negotiated this thing, you look stupid if you reject it, we're sort of back where we are at the moment. What the government needs to do is to have an obligation, as it were, to collect support as it goes through, so that these final steps actually are more or less pro forma.
Are there any scrutiny systems which you think would be good models for the UK to copy?
I'd give two examples. The government is always very keen to say that we should look at Westminster models. And I think that that is fine up to a point, but there are plenty of others that we can look at. The two that I would mention, the first is the European Parliament. The European Parliament has two things guaranteed in treaty that I think are critical. The first is a right to information, which, as Alan pointed out, is very important. We currently have that under this commitment that's colloquially known as the Grimstone Rule, and I think it is observed to a point, but it's certainly not incumbent on the government to provide the sorts of levels of information that I think are seen in the European Parliament. And the second benefit that the European Parliament has is the veto that we were discussing earlier. Under Article 218 of the treaties, it has a specific right to a veto, which I think is generally recognised to have generated the sort of information and other things being provided at an early stage so that its committees can get to delve into these agreements. But going to the government's other point about Westminster systems, I've done a bit of work with the Fijian Parliament, and they have a model constitution that was sort of set up for them relatively recently. They have in their constitution a setup where their Foreign Affairs Committee gets to look at treaties if they want to, including trade agreements and a veto. So it's not even true, as the government says, that all Westminster systems don't do this. It is possible to set this up within the auspices of something that looks more like what we do.
Yeah, I mean, there's something slightly perverse about saying, here we are in a Westminster system, could we do better? Well, we'll look at the other Westminster systems. Alex has given us an example, which I confess I didn't know of, a Westminster system that is formally better. But it's also true to say these systems tend to work also through a whole series of conventions and informal rules. So in Australia, for instance, they've explained to me in DFAT that when they get close to a signature, the senior management of DFAT and the politicians fan out across the country and have town hall meetings and explain to pressure groups what's going on. In other words, even though it's not obligatory, the convention has grown up that there is consultation and information. And so part of our problem, because it's all so new to us, and frankly, because the politics have been so poisonous since Brexit, is we haven't developed any sort of informal conventions that make a clunky system work better. But I'm delighted to hear that, in fact, we've got an example from Fiji where we can, you know, nail some more sensible stuff on the side.
Just to briefly come back on this, I think the cultural aspects are really quite important. Alan pins down a point we haven't discussed yet and might want to turn to, which is that of transparency. The UK government is pretty bad at putting into the public domain what exactly it is it's doing, the objectives, who might be the winners, who might be the losers, until a very late stage. And they haven't always been straightforward even with that. If we recall what they said about the Japan trade deal that they made, they made claims that it did things that weren't actually correct. If you compare other Westminster jurisdictions like New Zealand, we found when we were dealing with them that bluntly they put a lot more in the public domain. They wanted to take the public with them on this arrangement. It wasn't sprung upon people at short notice without the necessary information. And I think that cultural aspect towards transparency is something we have to think about in the UK.
Now, one of the things we've touched on a couple of times is the fact that trade policy is a centralised responsibility within the UK, and the devolved administrations have to play their part at some level. But I'm wondering, what would be a suitable level of involvement or oversight for those devolved administrations? Mary, I wonder what your view is on that.
I would just echo initially what Alan said about my understanding of the informal and official level engagement that, you know, is happening. And it's definitely from my work with the devolved administrations in Scotland and Wales, it does seem to be happening in quite a constructive manner. Some of the issues, though, when talking to officials and the DAs, is simply that they're asked questions about particular impacts that particular parts of agreements might have, and they just don't have much information to be able to respond. They're not really sure how big an impact it's going to have or if it's an issue, because the data that we have just isn't sufficient. So they're having some issues with being able to have the data and research available to be able to respond. But as well as official level, you know, behind closed doors, and it is, you know, confidential and it doesn't, you know, reach the light of day, the question would be around what role the devolved parliament should have also in the scrutiny of these deals and understanding. And all of this just leads to the need for more research. We'd say that as a researcher, I suppose, but more research, more data and more capacity in the devolved administrations and the devolved parliaments to be able to do analysis, I guess constructively engage with this positive engagement from DBT, but also to scrutinise it from the Parliament's perspective.
Absolutely concur with what Mari said there. I think the point about having the research and the capacity, but also having the capability and the resource. So for example, in Northern Ireland, I have a very small team. I effectively have four people who look after the whole of the international trade agenda from a Northern Ireland perspective. So very good people, but we have to cut our cloth accordingly. We can't go into perhaps the levels of detail and analysis that we may like to. That's just a fact of life and how we're resourced at the moment. But I do come back to the point just about the devolved settlements and really those having to be respected as the basis for all engagement in this area. So the Northern Ireland Assembly really needs to have the autonomy to legislate in its areas of competence. And I know that sounds like a very obvious thing to say, but we have experience in this process where that maybe has become blurred and hasn't always been the case. So from my perspective, the key to that is always going to be good, early and consistent engagement with Whitehall, actually across the board on all trade policy issues. Look, we do, of course, recognise that UK government is going to set the wider parameters of its reserve trade policy objectives. But where the devolved issues come into scope, we really need to have the flexibility for Northern Ireland to pursue those elements of that international agenda that aligns best with, in my case, the executive's economic priorities.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate just for a moment. I've spoken to a number of MPs and asked them, if you had had a vote on the Australia-New Zealand agreement, would you have voted against? None of them said no. So are the concerns about the scrutiny of our trade agreements perhaps a little academic and a little overstated? What do we think?
My view is that one can't expect parliamentarians to spend huge amounts of time on international trade. I mean, we've wasted all our lives on this stuff. To us, it's vitally important, but to most people, it's not. So I think the issue is not so much whether there are specific issues which they would have taken up, but that is there a system set up that recognises that what they think matters and that therefore is geared up from the start to deliver something that they are likely to think useful. We have a parliamentary system and we have whips and the government has almost perfect control over the way that its MPs vote. It needs to be a major issue to get MPs to rebel, or even in the case of the Labour Party, to appear to be not very constructive. So I think the question is not so much how would they have voted, but they didn't have the opportunity to start with. They didn't focus on it. They're not particularly concerned. And so I think one wants to set up a system that moves more organically towards taking into account the opinions which they represent.
It's the precedence you set. It's all very well to say, well, we're quite relaxed about our arrangements with New Zealand or Australia. But as you mentioned at the beginning of the programme, the government is negotiating trade arrangements with the Gulf states, with India. There may be all sorts of issues that arrive, anything from human rights to immigration with those countries, where Parliament might want to get involved far more. And once you set the precedent that says you don't have a voice and we don't take you seriously, it's much more difficult then for Parliament to exercise any power over these. And so I think it's important we get it right first time. And if we're doing that with less contentious arrangements, so much the better.
So let's take a little look into the future. There will be a general election in this country at some point in the next 9 months or so. The opinion polls seem to suggest that there's a strong probability that there'll be a change of government at that point. Labour have hinted very strongly that they want to improve the oversight of trade policy if they win the next election, but they've made no promises and they haven't really provided any details. So what could we expect from a possible future government in terms of changing the way this is done? What have you heard? What would you like to see, perhaps, in the next parliament?
So the Labour Party has made encouraging noises through Jonathan Reynolds' speech in November, December, about improving scrutiny. And it hasn't given us much detail. In some sense, I guess I'm not awfully surprised. They're very nervous about spelling stuff out for good and sometimes bad reasons. One of the things that Jonathan Reynolds did speak about in pretty concrete terms was establishing a more independent board of trade to act essentially as an honest analyst and information provider. That's something which the Trade and Business Commission advocated back in June, some people even earlier. I've been heavily involved with that and certainly believe there's an independent board of trade would seriously improve the quality of both scrutiny and actually public engagement with international trade. It's not that the stuff that the Department of Business and Trade have put out is dishonest, but we don't trust it. Actually, it's the government speaking. And these things involve a lot of judgment. They are not absolutely cut and dried engineering issues. And to have skilled, informed, independent assessments published obligatory with parliamentary oversight of these things would be a great step towards establishing the legitimacy of whatever it was that the government wished to do. So Reynolds was pretty specific, and I would hope that indicated that it is something that we might move towards. But in truth, who knows, or at least who knows until the manifestos are published.
I think you've got almost two elephants in the room here. The first is that if you want to bring in the veto power, you would need to amend the CRAG, the legislation. And I don't think this will be a priority for a new government, certainly in its first few years. The second is our relations with the European Union. The Labour Party have not been entirely clear-cut as to how they want to improve our relations with the EU. And trade policy seems to be determined on two fronts, the rest of the world and what we do with the EU. And I think until it becomes clearer what we do with the EU, it's going to be difficult to know how they're going to address the rest of the world. In terms of what we could do if you don't see CRAG reformed immediately, I think there is an argument to be said that the Grimstone rule sets out many of the things that we want to see, but it needs to be formalised rather better so that the government doesn't ignore it. And were Labour to give concrete commitments that it would observe the Grimstone rule, not only in the House of Lords, but also in the House of Commons, you would have much better engagement, I think.
Alan Ramsey, Northern Ireland has a very specific setup within the UK's trade framework. It's part of the UK Customs Union, but it's de facto part of the EU single market. In what ways is this very singular situation taken into account with the UK's trade agreements? And how do you think that could be better taken into account?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Chris. We do have now a set of arrangements that are certainly new and unique in Northern Ireland, and it's taken a period of time to adjust to those. So we now have concepts such as dual market access, we have red and green lanes, we have various other different things to get our heads around. So a lot of that landscape is starting to feel more stable at this point where we are now 8-9 years into this process. So I think when it comes to Brexit in general, like, it's not unusual to say there's been a lot of flux, there's been a lot of uncertainty, there's certainly been a degree of figuring it out in real time. And I think that's probably been amplified in the Northern Ireland context. And I think you allude to a good example of that, actually, just in terms of how Northern Ireland sits in and benefits from UK trade agreements, particularly on the import side, given that unique set of trading arrangements we now have. So what that has required UK negotiators to do is a lot of explaining about the status of Northern Ireland with trading partners, potential FTA partners, because it is complex and it's been evolving. So the line that we have seen the UK government use now in all of its agreed FTAs gives precedence to those arrangements, to the Northern Ireland Protocol, the Windsor Framework arrangements. But interestingly, the provision itself within those agreements is actually quite high level, and therefore we anticipate it's going to give us a degree of flexibility, or at least we hope it will, which I think we're going to need as we move into that implementation phase. I think you alluded to it already, Chris, that as civil servants here in Northern Ireland and in Whitehall, there's still an awful lot to unpack in terms of understanding how the Northern Ireland arrangements, you know, via the protocol, the framework, and the latest version, the Safeguarding the Union command paper, how that all interacts with free trade agreements in practice. Because pretty much up to this point, we've been in the theoretical space in negotiation. So I see a very important role here for some of the structures that have been established around the Windsor Framework. So, for example, the Specialised Committee, the Joint Consultative Committee, and the various subgroups set up under the new FTAs, just to really deep dive into some of those implementation issues and explore where some of that flexibility might be best employed. So yeah, a complicated area, and I think we're moving from theory into practice fairly rapidly.
So as we move towards wrapping up our podcast today, one question I'd like to put to all of you just to conclude, and that is, what do you think are the prospects for improved trade scrutiny structures and processes in the next 5 to 10 years? What would you like to see in terms of changes to the way trade is scrutinised in the UK? Mary, perhaps we can start with you.
The first thing I would say would be about the availability of research and data on trade and the impacts of different arrangements on different sorts of businesses, different citizens and workers in different regions of the UK. Because if there are better legislative or scrutiny arrangements put in place for the Westminster Parliament, or indeed for the devolved parliaments, my worry is that the questions that politicians will have of the different deals, we're not going to be able to answer, because we're just not going to know what the impacts might be on different industries or workers. So one of the real barriers here to scrutiny in practice, I suppose, and Alan mentioned we're moving from this theoretical space to the practical implementation of these deals, is being able to evidence and answer these different questions that people might have as they carry out scrutiny. So my hope and my wish would be that over the next decade, there's a significantly a greater effort by central government to make data about trade available for research in order for us to help politicians answer some of these questions.
Alex?
What strikes me at the moment is that the systems that we have that do scrutiny well are all in the House of Lords. My hope would be that going forward, we see a lot more engagement with the Commons about this. I mean, we shouldn't be overly critical, because these structures have grown organically over a small number of years. I think it took the Australians quite a while to establish their sort of much more serious treaty scrutiny joint committee and do the work that they do. But I think the time has really come for the Commons to engage with this proactively and recognise that it's not really doing a good job, and that it can't lean on the House of Lords, where there aren't any powers to do anything about these issues forever.
Alan Ramsey, what's your take on this?
I will give a view as an official, Chris, and I've already alluded to it. What would really make the difference for us would be how information is shared. Not all information around trade policy is sensitive or secret and should therefore not be shared in such a manner, which sounds like a small thing, but as officials working on this stuff can inhibit good analysis and understanding of the issues and just the timeliness of how information is shared. We are often frustrated when we receive information post an important decision or too late in the day. So that would be my hope and aspiration.
Alan Winters, a final word from you.
I think the prospects for the next decade are about 50-50 for an improvement. In terms of formal structures, governments don't like giving away power. And so I think the time that we will see a change in formal structures will be with the manifestos coming up and the possible change of government. And frankly, if it didn't happen in the first week, I wonder whether it would actually happen. Think of the independence of the Bank of England. Think of the Office of Budget Responsibility, both introduced with a change of government immediately. And I think that's where we might get formal change. Going forward in time, I hope that we will develop a more cooperative and constructive way of viewing these things. And in a sense, I think that's just part and parcel of calming everything down, trying to view policy in a more sort of technical and constructive way rather than purely as a political knockabout. So 50-50.
50-50. That's the best we'll have to take for the moment. There we have to wrap up our podcast today. Many thanks indeed to my guests, Professor Alan Winters, to Marius Bowage, to Alexander Horn and Alan Ramsey. Thank you all for joining us. And last but by no means least, thanks to all of you for listening in. So do catch us again soon for the next episode of Trade Bites. Trade Bites is brought to you by the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy, supported by the Economic and Social Research Council.